The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 172, Dressing the Body, a panel discussion with Marnie Asplund Campbell, Carol B. Quist, Tessa Santiago, Jennifer Englund, Charlotte Englund, and Allison Pingree.
Let's begin. Welcome, all of you. I feel like I'm starting Relief Society right now. Any visitors in the ward today? We're very pleased, really pleased, that you're all here. My vision for this panel was that it be really a very lively and interesting conversation that I would want to have in my life, in my living room, at my kitchen table, wherever, but that it be all part of us doing it. So I'm excited that you're here, and I hope that you'll think of this as a conversation that I'll be guiding, of course, but that you feel like this is... And the other, I think, aim that I had was to really explore in a constructive and in a very tangible way this very significant church experience, which is Relief Society, and in our cases, being a president of a Relief Society. I want to introduce the panelists first, and then I will begin with what I have to say, and I will allow the panelists to speak their piece. Then after that, things will kind of proceed... kind of with a random but directed chaos. If there are questions that come up that I think need to be addressed, I might bring them up. If you just want to stand up and verbalize a question, great. If you feel more comfortable passing it forward, maybe just let it work its way to the front and one of these people can hand it forward to us. So that's the way it will go. We have Allison Pingree to my left. Allison served as a... Oh, shoot, I don't have my... She was actually a counselor in a Relief Society presidency in Cambridge in a student ward in 1986-87. Also was a Relief Society teacher for many, many years, 8 years. Next to her is Charlotte Englund, who was a Relief Society president in the late 60s in Stanford, in Palo Alto, and then in Minnesota from 1970 to 1973. And next to her is Jennifer Englund, who was a Relief Society president in a singles ward in Provo in the 80s. And next to her is Carol Quist, who was a Relief Society president from 1976 to 1978 in Saudi Arabia. And I am Marnie Campbell. I'm currently president of the Relief Society in the Seattle 7th Ward in Seattle, Washington. That's as much as I'm going to say about these individuals. I'll let them speak for themselves when their time comes. To begin with, one of my favorite things to do when I taught at BYU, which I did for several years, I was an English teacher, and in discussing the importance of gender-neutral language, invariably would have students say, well, everyone knows when you say he or man and mankind that we mean women too. And, so I'd like to bend their minds a little bit when they'd be discussing the scriptures, and I'd say, well, then that must apply to the scriptures about priesthood as well, doesn't it? And they'd have to stop like a dog hearing a strange sound. They never thought of that before. I think that there's one scripture, however, which I feel and believe really does refer to men specifically, and it's the scripture in Doctrine and Covenants, section 121, which says, we have learned by sad experience that it's the nature and disposition of almost all men, not just men and women, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. I have come to believe in my observations in my relatively short, I guess, church career, but it's been intensified, I think, by my experience as a leader in the Relief Society, that is very much applicable to male leaders. But I'm interested in exploring why that's the case, and I think that just my sort of random, casual polls of people, I think most people feel the same way, that women in positions of leadership have very different experiences from men in positions of leadership. I think it's interesting that Scripture says almost all men, not just sometimes, not there's a possibility, but that almost all of the time. And so my other interest is in if it is the case that women in positions of leadership manage to avoid this unrighteous dominion, how can it be that we can perhaps permeate the rest of the church structure and bring that kind of positive, whatever people perceive as positive church experience. I know many, many people who have left the church and are very unhappy with the church who love Relief Society and speak of Relief Society in hallowed and reverential tones. So I think there's something very special about it. in sort of to kind of bring this to a specific experience as a Relief Society president, I do a lot of filling of food orders, which I give to people that need food to go to the Bishop's Storehouse. And as part of that, I spend time with those people. I fill out the orders, discuss their needs, sometimes go into their homes, often drive to the storehouse because they don't have cars, get the food, bring it back. And not in any way to be a martyr, but it is a lot of work. It's a great deal of work, and it entails, I think, my need to be tactful and loving and compassionate as I do it. And one of the things that troubled me when I was first a Relief Society president was that I could go to all the work of filling out the order. It could not be taken to the storehouse until my bishop had signed the bottom. He who I'm certain has counseled these individuals, perhaps in other settings, but I'm the one that has spent the time with them, perceiving and trying to gently and compassionately work with their needs. And that bothered me. And so I told my bishop, that bothers me, that I have to get your signature after I have given this service. And so his response was to sign a stack of forms and give them to me so I wouldn't have to worry about it. Now, he's a wonderful bishop. Nevertheless, that doesn't eliminate the reality that as much as I work in the Relief Society, and I do work, as many women here can attest to, ultimately, there's that final say-so that has to take place. So I think that we'll all maybe kind of bear that in mind as we begin sharing our experiences. I'll pass the time over to Allison.
Do you want to stand or you can use that? Is it better if I stand or can sit? Or you want me to stand?
We'll all introduce ourselves now, and then we'll begin questions.
One of the questions that Marnie circulated to us in preparing for the session is one that I want to focus in on most. It's kind of a pair of questions. When have I most felt that I was working as a conduit for divine contact or guidance as a spiritual leader? And what relationship might there be between the body and the spirit as I worked as a spiritual leader, or when I was feeling this divine contact or guidance? And the answer that has come to me is that I think I have felt most as somehow in contact with divinity in guiding and leading as a sister, either in the Relief Society or in other callings. It's been when I've personalized standard procedure and when I've shaped and enacted rituals to meet the needs of those with whom I'm involved in personal relationships based on personal knowing and shared experience and not obligation and structure. So it's about an owning, a tailoring, a personalizing, and it's about ritual. It's about something concrete, very often bodily and involved in daily life. So I want to talk about how I've come to this sense of things in three different contexts, two within Relief Society and then one on my mission. So kind of expanding the rubric a little bit of this session. On my mission, I think that was when I felt the most connected to God in an ongoing way. And I don't know how much now I really was connected to God or just that I felt that I was in a zealous way. But I think there I learned the importance of both personalizing ritual as well as not doubting myself and my intuition and my own sense of what people needed. And I came to see this through a couple of experiences. The first was that for a while in my mission, I regularly conducted baptismal meetings. I did so just because it seemed natural. I had conducted meetings before in church, in Relief Society, and as a young women's leader. And so given that in the place where I was working, the families that we were baptizing didn't know the elders at all because they lived in another area, it seemed natural for me to welcome the families and to shape the meeting and make it somehow personal to them. It did occur to me, however, somewhere along the line that what I was doing might not be kosher, and so I asked the mission president. I know. I mean, before my mission, I had read Linda King Newell's article, A Gift Given, A Gift Taken. I knew better, but I just somehow thought, well, if I explain my reasons and I explain why I'm doing this, surely he'll understand. Well, his response surprised me, although it shouldn't have, that I really shouldn't be doing this. Another context came when I was involved in teaching another family for a period of time, and all but the father decided to join the church. We continued to see them very frequently and felt very close to them. The father became ill and died. My companion and I, when we learned that he died, we went immediately to the house and spent a fair amount of time with the family, and including our decision to go to the wake. We didn't stay for the whole wake. It was in Colombia, South America, and it happened over a period of several days with his body laid out in the living room. But we did decide to go and be part of that, and to meet some family members, but also then to take some time with the members of the family that had joined the church in a separate room to sing "Oh My Father," to talk about what our sense or our belief was about where their husband and father was at the time. And I didn't care whether there was some guideline about whether or not you should go to a Catholic wake in the family's home. It wasn't a question for me. It was just that this is where we should be. But I also wanted to have them share with them what I believed about where their loved one was. And that felt truer to me. That felt right. And again, it was very concrete and bodily in the sense that we were literally near his body, but also using known forms of ritual, a hymn, praying, to come together in a really individualized way. The second context where I've felt spiritually energized as I personalized and adapted ritual and procedure has been as a Relief Society and education counselor for many different, in a couple of different contexts for about 8 years. The lessons that I feel strongest and best about tend to be ones that I've made up pretty much completely whole cloth on my own. I sometimes will take a topic from the manual and use it as a way to brainstorm with the scriptures, but I feel very strongly that I need to respond to the desires and needs of the sisters in my ward. So the lessons that I remember giving and feeling excited about having given are things like ones on depression, ones on gossip, ones on spiritual differences within marriage, and child abuse. A final experience that occurred in the context of me being a visiting teacher and a friend of a mother and a daughter over several years occurred within that context of that friendship, where during those years I witnessed the excruciating process of the mother, whose name was Annie, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and underwent the slow and steady decay of her mind and her body, and then eventually died after a stroke at the age of 91 2 years ago. Cynthia, the daughter, had long stopped her involvement with the church because of a variety of negative experiences with church leaders and at BYU. But after her mother died, she wanted to honor her mother's wishes to have her body dressed in the Orthodox Mormon way. Annie, her mother, had been endowed and had continued to be involved in the church until close to her death. Because I had known and cared for Annie, and because our Relief Society president was bedridden with a pregnancy, I was the one to dress Annie. And Cynthia had prepared for this in anticipation and had asked me to make sure that we had the clothes, and so I actually was the one to end up calling Church Distribution Center, and the box came several weeks before Annie actually died because she had had this stroke and was nearing her death, and so the box sat in my living room waiting. And then after Annie did die, I and her daughter and another woman from the ward went to dress Annie's body. This experience really was one of the most profound experiences I've ever had, not the least of which was because it was an utterly bodily ritual, one which also I think is not unrelated to the experience that I had giving birth to my daughter. There were discoveries that I made then that are still etched deeply into my consciousness about the fact that we all will be horizontal someday. Just as after I gave birth, I was stunned by realizing that every single person in the world had come out of a woman's body. I mean, I knew that, but I didn't really know that. And and seeing Annie's naked body, a very short, she was not even 5 feet tall, and she must have weighed about 75 pounds when she died. Seeing her there and seeing myself in her dramatically changed how I see the way that I live my life and how I see my own body. I was struck by a sense of sacredness of Annie's wizened, wrinkled body, the details, her small sagging breasts, the indentation that was still on her nose, even though she hadn't had her glasses on for a couple of days, her fingernails, which were painted bright pink, and she never painted her fingernails, but the nursing home had painted her fingernails. And she was both at once very present. I almost expected her to crack a joke and open her eyes and laugh, but yet extremely absent. There was so very much of Annie that was not there, and it became clear to me that it was unimaginable that all that she was had simply stopped existing. So in a strange way, it confirmed a sense of afterlife for me to see her there and to touch her body. The best part of it, though, was that Cynthia, her daughter, was there. And I didn't really know all of the protocol about whether someone who has not been endowed should be in the room or not, but I just knew that her daughter should be there. And Cynthia was hesitant about whether she wanted to see her mother dressed, but I urged her to seriously consider it, and I think she was glad that she did. The mortician and I actually did the dressing of the body, but Cynthia watched. We sang hymns. Come, Come, Ye Saints was a particularly moving one that we sang, and then Cynthia veiled her face. And I just remember thinking at the time, let the sin be on my head if this is wrong, because this daughter and this mother really bonded in a very important ritual, I think, at that time. So I think I still have a lot of questions and feelings of contradiction. How much to adapt, how much to personalize, how much am I silencing myself by continuing to teach Relief Society in a rather moderate way compared to what I really think. It's true. So as to not alienate and so as to make possibly some difference. The one thing that I do know, though, is that these personalized and endlessly adaptable ritual grounded in the body and in daily life are really the only way that I can now see being involved in the institution of the Mormon Church making sense to me. So that's all for now.
Charlotte asked if I would go next because she, too, was speaking about dressing the body. I was a Relief Society president in the first young adult ward. This was not a BYU ward. This was the first young adult ward, and I'll be explaining that in my notes. In 1978, I was a young college freshman living at home being a stone's throw away from BYU campus. I, along with my neighborhood student-at-home friends, attended home wards. Not living on campus meant no campus wards for us. We started to create our own young adult ward by meeting at homes on the front lawn of our bishop. And very soon, the young adult ward was born. And we were embraced by the church and sanctified and we got our own chapel. I was amazed and very encouraged that the church turned its head and took notice of a small cluster of students. It was at this time in this ward that I was called to be the Relief Society president. I took this calling with the same seriousness and devotion as I did my membership to this young, struggling, working ward. Because I belonged to the home stake, I would attend the Relief Society stake presidency meetings with the other Relief Society's presidents of home wards. It was at these meetings that it caused me great questioning and confusion. The other Relief Society presidents referred to as Sister Brown, glad that you're here, Sister Smith, and I was always referred to, oh, we're so glad, Jennifer, you're here to represent the youth. I didn't feel I received the same respect and seriousness to my calling that I had felt myself. I started to question the purpose of my calling. Was I just play acting? Was I in a ward that was just another scheme for us wandering singles to get married? I was also asked to involve the bishop's wife to attend my presidency meetings so that she could oversee the work. I didn't lose hope or despair. I knew that this ward was developing wonderful, responsible adults, opportunities that they normally would not have had. I didn't feel, though, that we were being completely trusted for us to do our jobs as adults because of the constantly overseen by the bishop's wife and attitudes that were there. So I made a phone call to the bishop. I asked him why he had called me to this position and let him know of my devotion, and that if I were to be a True Relief Society president, I could not answer to his wife, and that I wanted to set an example and a tone for my counselors and fellow members. We had real callings and responsibilities. I spent the rest of my time as Relief Society president building up the sisters' confidence. It was a challenge to help them see their potential and overlook their young age, helping them find their identity at a time of their lives when they just didn't fit in. We had become strangers in our familiar church. No one in our ward was married, nor did they have children, and yet this was supposed to be our example and goal. Many sisters would come to me and ask me if they should quit school and only take child care classes. Some were confused by general conference talks, giving examples of the ideal woman at home with children. How did this apply to them as single students, as working women? I tried to remind them of the things the prophet did not say. The prophet had not said quit school. The prophet did not say stop your education. He did not say stop fulfilling yourself, your creativity, and your interests. I did not have to address, nor did I have to assist in welfare evaluation. I did, however, see some very young women grow up and find identity.
My experience with Relief Society has a wide range, and as many of you could probably relate to, I remember as a child being underneath the quilts that were laid out in the front room, and my mother and the sisters doing their quilting, and thinking, gee, we're having a lot more fun under the quilt than they are on top, aren't we? Surely we are, but I didn't know that they were really having a good time. And that goes to our experience in Samoa, where as a newly married couple, teaching Relief Society women there who were much older than I was, but most of that time was spent not on a quilt, but on the floor, cross-legged on the floor, weaving mats. And then to Stanford, where we had the full-blown bazaar time, and the many, many hours and weeks that we spent together creating these little whatever we were making. And then to Minnesota, where I was to be a district Relief Society president, which was a totally new experience for me. And this came about after we had just moved there, been there just maybe weeks, I mean 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And I got a call from the mission president from Minneapolis. We were in a little town, Northfield, where Jean was at the St. Olaf College. And there had been this little woman who had been in the nursing home, or the Odd Fellows home, as they call it, and had died, had been invalid for several years and was very crippled. And she was a Mormon and wanted to have the full funeral. And so the mission president's wife called me and asked me if I wouldn't dress her. And I said, I've never done this before, and I didn't tell her my feelings about death and bodies and things, that I've always had a terrible fear of death, and so I wasn't totally comfortable about this. And I said, isn't there a Relief Society president around that you could call on to do this job? She said, no, we don't have anybody there, and we would really like you to do it. She says, I'll arrange to get the clothes down to you. So they sent them down. And I then, in the meantime, in this little Lutheran town, was trying to find a member of the church that would help me, and I called three different women, and they all turned me down. And finally, I got one who was not, it was kind of active, but was willing to do it. And we went down, took the clothing down. My family fasted and prayed for me. I was so frightened. And we went into the mortuary, and the body was there. And she was this was the first time I had seen her, just a frail little woman. And her legs were all bent back. She hadn't been able to straighten her legs out for about 6 years. And I thought, what do I do? How do I do this? And we were alone in the room, and it was softly lit. And I just felt if I was ever going to have the Spirit of the Lord to guide me through this, I needed it now. And it came. It was such a blessing to us, because this little woman, there was a reverence to it, as Allison describes. It just changed my whole feeling about death, so that it helped me overcome a lot of fear that I had. And we were able to dress her, and then we started talking about her and just imagined her. We knew she had children, and we just kind of imagined her doing the activities that she would have done as a mother, and how long she had been without this, and how long she had been where she couldn't walk or sit up. So it was a great blessing to me to have this experience. And it wouldn't have happened, I think, in another organization where professionals would have taken over this job. So it ended up being not only a great remembrance, but a closeness to my friend that as we did this together, and also drew near to this woman that we had never met. It also gave me a sense of what Relief Society is all about, and it's a lot of things, but this is one of them, that we serve in ways that we wouldn't normally do, and we find by doing that things in us come out that we didn't think we had the ability to do, and I think that's the thing that really helps us grow. The things that I find we were meeting in a small branch, and the area that I had to cover was from Rochester, just this side of, and then just this side of Minneapolis, and so it was a long distance. In the wintertime, it got a little bit hectic, as you are aware of the winters in the Midwest. But there were some great times there, and I couldn't have done it without the counselors that I had, and that was the other thing that I found was a wonderful experience for me. I didn't know any of the women who were there. And I had to get my counselors and the secretary, and so I had gone up to meet Jean for lunch at the college, and while we were, and he had met a colleague there who was a Mormon, and so we were going to have lunch with them, and while we were waiting for his wife to come up, I saw this woman coming up the hill with this baby on her back, and I said, she's my counselor. She's going to be my counselor. And her husband, Frank, said, well, that's my wife. And I said, well, she's going to be my counselor. And so that was one time. And then the next Sunday, we were in district conference in Rochester. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to select my other counselors. And while we were sitting there, I saw this woman sitting with her husband. And I said, she's my other one. And so we put together this wonderful presidency, and that I could not have done the job had it not been for these women who together we were learning and struggling. But we all had different talents that just complemented each other and supported one another. And I found that and the experience was so overwhelming to me, because all of a sudden, as I was visiting branches, women were coming to me with questions as if I knew something. And I thought, this is what it's like to have to be an authority of something. This is, or at least pretend to be, and they think you know something, so they're asking questions, and you're supposed to give them some kind of answers. And a couple of times I bluffed my way through, and I thought, who am I kidding? I don't know any more than these women do. I just happen to be in a different chair than they are. I happen to be on this side of the podium and they're on that side. And so I really tried to create a spirit there of sharing with one another and learning from one another. Because I said, you know, we're learning. And we're here to help you do anything that we can. But we're learning as we go, and we want to learn from you. And we did do that. the things that I miss that we don't have now that we had then are the classes that we had. We had such a range of things to learn about, and I loved learning about authors and composers. And I was a and now I guess now. Because the lessons are so, you can't really distinguish one lesson from another one. I guess what they're trying to tell us is we have a lot of bad things to overcome. I mean, I come away feeling so guilty that I long for the days that we were just learning about Beethoven or Mozart, you know, and I don't know what, so their lives weren't the best, but gee whiz, look what they gave us and look what we can, what we can learn from. So I really, really miss that part of it. The other thing I miss, I know bazaars are things that we just laugh at now because of the hours and hours, but there was and it wasn't because of the bazaars, I'm sure it wasn't because of that, but there was a sense of community that we had, working together, doing those things together, sharing these things, helping with each other's kids. There was a sense that we really were a family together, working together. And now we don't have time for that. We go to our meeting and we have to get out for the next ward and we have to hurry and we can't sit and socialize. And if you do, then the second ward's in there waiting to come in for gospel doctrine. They're saying, what are these women sitting around here talking for? So I miss that. And I think consequently I see less activity in a display of our talents and our gifts. I think we've been it's too consolidated to where we don't have as many opportunities to really express ourselves. I mean, some woman may play the saxophone really good, and we used to use something like that in a talent show or a skit that we do. And I miss those things. I'm sure there's wisdom, there's great wisdom in all of this. Not what I'm saying, but in the consolidated meetings. And I'm very fortunate to be in a ward where the Relief Society president has come up with an idea, and maybe it's because she was in Russia with her husband as mission president, that she had to scramble for space and time and ideas and ways to bring these sisters together and work together. So she's developed a visiting teaching program in our ward that I love. And we're assigned according to groups of women, 3 women, 2 women, 4 women, whatever they want to do. And we choose an activity that we do together once a month. We may go to a museum. We just went to a quilt museum down in Springville. And I happened to be with a woman who's a very fine quilter. And it was absolutely delightful to go there with her. Or we might get together and our visiting time is not 15 minutes rushing through a lesson. Sometimes it's 2 hours. But we get all kinds of things out, and it's so therapeutic and so wonderful, and you get so close to the sisters this way. It's been a wonderful program, but it takes someone who's willing to be innovative and daring enough to try something like this. And I don't know if she asked the bishop. I mean, she seems like the person that would ask a bishop, but if she didn't, I'm glad she didn't, and it's really working well. And I think if they tried to change it back, there would be a real protest. And I can just see the Relief Society sisters out there with their signs, saying, we want to start, go back to the other way again. But these are just some of my experiences. And I love... I love being with the sisters, and there's just nothing quite like it. And I feel sorry for the men. They don't have the same thing in priesthood meeting, because I just, you know, sisters, first of all, they're much better prepared than they are in priesthood meeting, so the lessons are much more interesting. But I can tell you one thing that I found very difficult, that they still do, that they haven't changed, and they still have the centerpiece, they still have the table, and I knew that I was failing when I was assigned to do it for that week. And I'm sitting there in Relief Society, and I'm thinking, something's missing here. And I knew I just didn't have the right mind to do that sort of thing. Thank you.
I am really sorry that I didn't bring the grapes from the Sunstone office. Did not think about it. It would have been a wonderful decoration. I'm Carol Quist. I'm Sunstone Office Manager, but I have been a Relief Society President, possibly in the best place that you could be a Relief Society President, in one or two respects, and that is in Saudi Arabia. First, I would like to mention, however, I too have dressed the body, and with my sister, my birth sister, dressed my mother's body for burial. And realized that I had become the parent of my mother. And in that experience with my sister, had had an additional bond that we were both parents of our mother now. And that this was the last earthly office we could fulfill for someone who had done every possible office, you know, that she was capable of doing for her daughters. In addition, I addressed the body of a granddaughter, which is a wrenching experience because the child was premature. One of my daughters-in-law made doll clothes for her to wear. And it's okay with me if old people die. But it's not okay with me if little babies who didn't have a chance to live yet die. And so I'm still getting over that, and it's been quite a few years. But I want to move on to a related subject, which I call addressing the body. And I mean the body of sisters that I became responsible for in Saudi Arabia 20 years ago, about April conference time. Our branch president, I'm going to be giving you a lot of background intermixed with experience. How many people have lived in Al Khobar or Dhahran, Saudi Arabia? Okay, and that's the reason I'm telling you some things. He came to me and asked if I had a temple recommend. And I knew I was the new Relief Society president. I'd been there about 2 weeks. And I knew it was desperation and it was inspiration. Because I was with the Northrop Aircraft Group of companies. My husband was employed by the construction division of Northrop. Northrop had sold fighter planes and others to the Saudi government through the U.S. government and needed, of course, airports that could handle that kind of aircraft. So three airports were being modernized, one of whom Sarah may have walked past years ago, many, many years ago, in Khamis Mashhad, one in Dhahran and one in Taif, the summer palace. From Dhahran, you probably saw on the news during Desert Storm, we saw lots of places on the newscasts where we were that we were familiar with. So the desperation and inspiration part may have been, because I was part of the Northrop group, I had some privileges. One was APO mail. That's how we got our church materials into the country, mainly. Northrop also had other advantages. It had a company commissary, including a pork license. That meant we could import bacon, and we could have some of that decadent stuff that we Christians like. Dining hall, recreation center, and a bus system. We lived in the native community. We lived in a very upscale series of duplexes in a compound called Canoe. The access was by what we called Rubble Road, or Pothole Parkway. And the reason I mention it is it led to our compound, which was walled. And outside the wall, it doesn't exist. Whatever's out there doesn't matter. Anything. Rubble, dead creatures, garbage, whatever it is. And the wall was something that I observed among groups of our church members because of partly because of one of the things I have just said. Groups were privileged in different ways. Northrop had these privileges. The U.S. military mission had privileges. We were not privileged to use their commissary and their dining room. They were not privileged to use ours. Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, had its privileges. And women could drive on those company compounds. And they had phones. No one else much had phones that worked. I didn't have a phone in my home. So where I lived, women couldn't drive and we had no phones. It was usually quicker to drive to someone you wanted to speak with anyway than it was to try to go to your husband's office and use a phone. It was weird. We had a company car. That was the other part of the desperation and inspiration. That meant I had a driver. So there were many reasons I was called that I think possibly had to do with desperation. I think that it had to do a lot with inspiration also, because I think I was a kind of a tough kind of cookie that could operate under the restrictions of that country and so on. It's a non-alcoholic country, and it's a non-pork country. The people who lived above us in the duplex were deported because they were running a still in their bedroom. The people who moved in next were a Catholic family. They had kids about our age. I only mention this because it turned out that the Mormon mother and the Catholic mother turned out to be the only ones who were there during the days when the kids were coming home from school and so on. I'm not putting down any women who went outside the home to work under those conditions, because what they were doing is exactly what we women are doing nowadays. We are hustling jobs to get medical insurance for our families, or to support the family entirely, or whatever it is. And I don't put down those people that got jobs at the military mission so they could have commissary and other benefits, because they were doing exactly what every woman, I feel, does for her family. The Ensign at that time was running nice little articles about Maria in Costa Rica or whatever, and a day in the life of, I'm not putting that down in a way, but I am in another way, because I immediately wrote to the Relief Society General Board. I said, this is what life is like in Saudi Arabia. And no, of course, Ensign would never print it politically. It couldn't do it. Couldn't do that. We didn't want them to print it either. But I did that so they would know what I was going to do, and I asked them please to pray for us to do the best that we could and to send everything directly to me, APO, manuals, anything. My mom, all of our food, including the outside of cans. What's that other word? Disinfect. If you could get eggs, you often had to carry them, dotted with manure, in open flats for blocks, because it was quicker to do that than to try to go to a bus stop and get home. Bear Hoppy is over here nodding a lot, and I think she might have visited where I used to live. Frequent power outages in which you would lie on the floor and eat bananas because you didn't want to add to the heat by cooking anything. But the main thing was isolation. I'm going to mention this two or three times because that's what I felt was the greatest need to address among our sisterhood. I mentioned the Muslim kingdom.
Would you stand up? You see how I'm dressed. You see how I'm dressed. Jeans, I mean pants, shirt, belt. Very common among non-native women to wear that. Or they wore something like this. Very cool. We did not have to wear this stuff. This habaya and veil, because we were not natives. But this is what the native sisters wore. And I only wanted her to stand up by me because this is what we looked like downtown in Al-Khobar or anywhere else. This is a Christian sister. This is a Muslim sister. I bought this because I thought I would have some use for it on many occasions. What they wear underneath, could it be a bikini or anything else? It's also an example of dressing the body, isn't it? And there are some reasons behind that in Muslim culture. Women are considered to have high status or low status, whichever way you want to look at it. Foreign women have the least status. I had status because I had 4 sons. You can figure that out. Okay. No public worship is permitted. You meet in homes, you meet in the consulate, you meet in the Arabian-American compound. We met in the theater, scout room, various rooms. It's the only place I know of where the block system is a good thing. I'll tell you why. People come 10 miles, 15 miles, an hour and a half, an hour, to come to meetings. You sort of stagger your meetings, and you talk in between, and you talk afterward, and you go to one another's homes. And the people who've come an hour from somewhere come to your home after the meetings. It's the only place I know where you come and you become a community instead of having 10 minutes to get 35 children to the restroom in between 2 meetings. It's the only place I know the block system works. It's a wonderful thing for that situation. I think it allowed men time to socialize as well. Since women couldn't drive, we had all our meetings at night. All the auxiliary meetings were at night. Why? Men had to drive us there. And they waited for us, or they went, may have gone home. But what they did was sit around and talk too. It's a good thing. It was a good thing in that respect. Communication was a very big problem for me. I had Aramco, I had Northrop, I had Bechtel, and all other kinds of companies where they had no benefits for their employees. I had a few people who had dietary needs, and I end up buying from my commissary, the Aramco commissary, all kinds of couriers, so that we could meet a couple of diet needs that developed among sisters in our branch. We did a lot of walking, and we did a lot of driving that way. How did I communicate with my sisters? My kids got really tired of this. I sent notes with them to school on the consulate grounds. They delivered those notes to certain teachers. I mean, this was a system I had, who sent them to Aramco, who sent them to Bechtel, who sent them Fluor, a Saudi Arabian Fluor, wherever they were going. It was couriers. It was amazing. You put them to go into the Arabian American oil postal system or whatever. My son outside in the hall doesn't remember anything about that, but he sure complained at the time. So we had our haves and our have less and our have little and our haves nothing. We had families, mothers and children. We had single sisters. The single sisters were teachers or nurses. There were no female engineers. Our visiting teachers visited their neighbors, or they went with their husbands when they home taught. I did not like this because I felt that it was really important for women to talk to women by themselves. But I had to do what I could do to have people visited by other members of the church. At the time, lessons included mother education, social relations, spiritual living, homemaking, cultural refinement. We taught them all, and we taught them back to back because everybody wanted everything they could get. And so sometimes we had really long, late meetings. We did not have funerals. We did have one problem where we had to find a burial place for a Christian child in a Muslim country. And I went through my notes and I can't find out what we did. I don't know what we did. So there's no family lunch after the funeral. There is no food order going to distribution. There is no unemployment. There's no welfare needs. In Arabia, you are there because your spouse works there, or if you were a single sister working for the oil company. So you are there on a work visa and as a guest. If you get desperately sick, your company ships you out for medical care. We had a few people who were sick. We made a few meals and casseroles and did a little child care, but not very much. Not very much, because companies took care of any of the thing that was really major. Nobody had a child born there, one sister in the time I was there, because they all went stateside or to Europe or wherever. Where were my counselors? Inspiration, desperation. One at the oil company, one at the consulate, one at Bechtel, secretary somewhere else. Why did I have to do that? Well, they were fine sisters, but it's the communication. I had to have people in these satellite places. Arabia is a good place to hide from the church. If you don't want visiting teachers or home teachers, you just say so they won't bother you. All you have to do is complain and church members are deported. Out. No overt missionary work, therefore. But we still had some convert baptisms because we had some ways of putting up notes with a fish symbol, for example, in company recreation halls, and a phone number. The Fisherman's Society. I did two other things which I thought would help the image of Christianity or help to build community among sisters for whom I really had no responsibility. One was with the Northrop group of companies. I became the orientation leader for people coming into this country, for women coming into this country to give them some help in their daily life. So the things I was doing for my Relief Society, I did a little more of that for Northrop. Let's face it, when you come into that country, you land at an airport where birds are flying around in the ceiling and men are sleeping on the concrete floor. I hope it's better now. I'm not putting that down. I don't know how the birds got in there. I don't think they ever got out. People are sleeping on the concrete and the sidewalks because there's nowhere else to sleep. They don't have a home. But this is a culture shock that some people could not cope with and turned around and left the country. I also became director of what was then Sweet Adeline's chorus. Now I think it's called International Harmony. But we were so careful about missionary work that someone who had taught himself and been studying flew to Switzerland to find somebody at the temple to ask to be baptized. We were an English-speaking group, but we had a sister who had a child who spoke only French, and we had a Dutch brother who spoke French. And that's who we got to teach, that child. How did I manage to do this? How did I feel my line of authority went? It didn't go anywhere. It didn't come from anywhere except here. I didn't have to go talk. I had no stake organization. I had the branch president. I went to ward council and so on. But in many ways, I was on my own. And I prayed a lot, and I talked to my counselors a lot. We had a sister who was not clean, who had a real sanitation problem we became aware of in her home. But that sister knew how to grow things. How do you think we used that sister? Man, we had the visiting teachers over there teaching her how to take care of her children and prepare, keep her food sanitary and all this stuff. And we had her teaching us how to grow stuff. And that's pretty hard. In that climate in some respects. I've talked a really long time, and I'm sort of sorry about giving you all this history and environment and so on. But what it comes right down to, I felt, was trying to generate and maintain a community
female human beings who cared about each other, who could overlook the privileges that some had and didn't have, or to use those privileges in some way to improve people's temporal and spiritual existence. I look back through my minutes and newsletters and stuff, and I think, wow, somehow we did it. Somehow.
Thank you, all of you. That gave a wonderful, I think, beginning to I hope what can be a larger conversation. I think what we heard from everyone was a really nice variety of views. But the overwhelming question that I have, that has come out in different ways, I think, through the affirmation of Relief Society being a place where you can temper and create rituals, as Allison talked about, and I think Charlotte talked about it as well. As Jennifer said, where you sometimes encounter authority in a way that seems intrusive. As Carol talked about, where there is no authority and you wish you had some more. But I think the question that I'm faced with continually, for myself and often from friends, is, you know, am I doing more harm than good in serving in the way that I'm serving in Relief Society? Is the good that I do, or that we do, or that some of you may have done in creating this community of female human beings, negated by the fact that the community is embedded in a church that we may see as destructive or dangerous, or is it worth that to create that community? So that's a question I might ask of sisters on the panel, and if you want to respond to that as well, raise your hand and I'll call on you. Anyone want to address that? Well, now, Allison talked about teaching, and I think this is what made me think of it. You moderate your voice when you teach Relief Society. You're not saying everything you think as a feminist or as an intellectual or whatever you are. But do you feel like you're doing enough good just being there and teaching that you couldn't do if you were more outspoken? Is it worth the sacrifice?
I don't know. I've become more tired, I think, and more cynical about, well, maybe just less courageous, I suppose, about voicing what I really think. I mean, let me give two examples. 2 years ago, I decided to teach a lesson about pioneer women and sort of to create some sense of legacy. So I created portraits of about five women, mostly based on the Sister Saints book by Vicki Burgess Olson, and then had sisters read from their lives and basically made it a kind of reader's theater. And in that, I made a deliberate point to have the stuff from, say, Patty Sessions include her anointing and blessing women. And in that format, I just let it sit there. It was information that just was with the audience. A week ago, I taught a lesson on gifts of the Spirit and used Maxine Hank's book, Women in Authority, but A, didn't mention that it was that book. I sort of kept it down. brown cover, yeah. And I didn't make a deliberate... I made a deliberate point, in fact, to not talk about women laying hands on others. I was quoting contemporary women's experience about what women are doing now. And I was trying to get the women to start to think about not limiting what they do to gender roles. But I made the decision to not narrate experiences where women lay hands on each other or on their children. And I don't know how I feel about that.
Question, did you call it praying? What did you call it? What'd you name it? People need words.
Yeah. Blessed. I talked about how this is in Bettina Lindsay's article, Women as Healers. There's that one vignette of the woman relating when she was a 12-year-old. Her father was dying, and then in the morning, she felt that she should go down during the night to her father and didn't, and then in the morning, her mother said her father had died, and she sat down by her father, and they were waiting for the bishop to come, and she felt that she should pray, and she prayed. She didn't lay hands on him, but she prayed, and he opened his eyes and said, "What did you do?" I felt my lungs fill with air again. And there was a sister missionary excerpt that I edited. I didn't say, the sister missionary said, I laid hands on this sister, and I wasn't going to wait for the elders, blah, 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 blah. And I deleted that, and I just sort of talked about blessing. And I mean, maybe the person who is Bettina Lindsay here is the person who she was summarizing here. I just felt so hypocritical. I felt that I wasn't really doing justice to the experience, but I felt that if I started to give narratives of women saying, oh, we're not going to wait for the elders, and we're not, you know, we're going to lay hands on the head, half of the room or more was going to either just mentally dismiss me.
Yes.
Say what?
You would have been dismissed.
Or I would have been dismissed.
Probably more.
Because when, this is fascinating, because when we teach Relief Society and we bring in other intelligent people besides those that write the manuals, and I'm sure they're very intelligent, those people that write the manuals, but like you said, they've had those lessons for 50 years. Because you, what do you do? The book,
they recycle. Yeah.
So you enhance it and you feel the spirit and you feel some other authority coming down and saying, yeah, it's okay to use a little bit of Shakespeare. Or maybe it's a little okay to use a little bit of Judith Jameson as she incorporates the religion in her family. And then the next week, you're history, baby. I mean, the part about that, you didn't stick with the manual. Well, you're departing from the manual, but in a very careful way. I don't know how I feel right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'll sit down.
Jody had her hand up.
She has a lot of points.
Do you want to stand so people can hear you? Do you mind?
We'd like to have it on the tape. Oh, will it come out?
I think it's important to understand when to moderate, because it's true. Like you said, you go too far, you won't be there anymore. You won't be teaching anymore. But, and this is something I found, I think the most powerful thing we can do as Relief Society presidents is teach. And, but the thing that I found, as I find myself moderating and I do struggle, am I losing my courage? Mm-hmm. But another thing that I know is I need to find a balance so that I can still have the opportunity to teach. But the other thing is, the times when I felt the most pain from what other people have said is when they haven't moderated themselves.
When they have?
When they have not. In their own views. These are people who get up in gospel doctrine and slam the things that I find are very important to me, because they feel that their opinions are okay to be extreme and that their opinions are in line and everything. And I find myself thinking, you know, if they had thought a little bit about how harsh their words are and how many people their words are hurting, then maybe they would think twice again. And I think, well, maybe I need to think about that too. So in my moderation, the only ways that I'm moderating is by being very frank and honest. Am I going to cause pain and cancel out the teaching? Or where's the line drawn? Because I want to keep teaching, and that can cause pain, but how much can you teach before that?
Okay, now I feel like a deacon. Passing the mic. This is cool, Oprah. Who said Oprah? No, I've got the priesthood. I'm going to let Jennifer speak, and then remind me that it's you.
It was just a real quick comment, but they said they wanted this on tape. I think in giving lessons, you have a responsibility to know your audience. And like Jody said, if you don't and you just want to get up there and give your thing, you won't get anybody. But so it's knowing the audience. You can still sneak it in.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, appealing to your audience is an important part of a message.
I moderated lessons while I was a Relief Society teacher, but obviously not too much because I got fired. And moderating means censoring, and so I didn't have anything naughty to say that I thought would hurt anybody. I mean, Shakespeare and well, my sister and I both got fired because of Shakespeare. And poets and Thomas Wolfe and actually, Hitler would have improved those boring lessons in the manual. So I'm much more at ease being out of the Relief Society instead of standing up there every Sunday with sweat over my upper lip, afraid I might offend someone who's left their brain at home, which I think is really the only way you can go to Relief Society in some wards where they do the manual, is just to leave your brain at home and say, goodbye, honey, I'll see you in about an hour. Now, I want to tell you what I said that got me fired. And I said, because I hadn't really prepared the lesson very well, of course I had rewritten the whole manual, but I'd done it on Saturday night, so it wasn't a very good lesson. And I hadn't been drinking. I did it sober. But I said, God did not write this lesson, so if you hate it, don't blame God. And then I said, in fact, I don't think he writes any of the lessons. So if you like the lesson, don't give him credit. And 2 weeks later, I'd lost my job. But I'm happy to be out of the Relief Society. It's a big relief, and there's some tremendous television shows on right during the time my Relief Society is on. In fact, Loretta Young and Cary Grant are much better than that dreadful manual.
Now, if only you'd said she didn't write the manual, I think you really would have gotten in trouble.
I think you've all been just absolutely wonderful, and I can't sit there any longer. I think you're marvelous. Everything you've said is just inspiring. But I can't personally see why we have to go on treading on eggs, because the men are in charge. We don't wear whatever that is. We don't wear that either, and nothing will ever change until we say what we believe. And I think, as my psychologist husband has tried to teach me, very difficult, the method is the message, and you can say what you believe if you try to say it properly. And I don't mean you have to lie. You say it properly. You say it so that they can absorb it, so they don't feel so challenged, which I do challenge people too much. But I remember being back in New Jersey living. I was sitting on the State Board Relief Society in a pantsuit. When pantsuits came in, I wear dresses quite a lot in Utah because they don't like me at church in my pants. But back there, he said, fine, you're rolling up the cloths on the floor after, because I made these plastic cloths. It's okay to wear a pantsuit. He supported me. This was Brother Danes, who started the church in New Jersey in his home. They joined all the community organizations. Now it's a thriving community of stakes. And his son, you know, is my neighbor, teaches at BYU. Very good Mormons, very community oriented. They said it the right way. They didn't offend people. You can't know every woman from all the places they've been, even in my ward, which is called Orthodox, just above BYU. You can't know all those people and their experience. You can't do it. And so you can't please them all, and you can't try even, or you'd go crazy. Needless to say, I don't teach right now in Utah, though I was in every organization on both coasts where I lived. And I love the church, and I have a temple recommend, and I've worked for women's rights for 40 years. And so when people say, oh, you used to look so feminine, Nola, I say, well, no man's ever mistaken me for a man yet, even in pants. I think you can work, and I think you can do it right.
Thank you. Some of our panelists, Charlotte and then Carol.
I'm not sure I want this on the recording, but I guess I'll take my chances. It's just sad that when we're out in these little branches, we're so glad for warm bodies. We don't care what they're wearing. We're just glad to have them there and, you know, create a family and a community there. And I hear this, and I suffer the same way in my ward. And these are good women. I am guilty of not doing near the service that they do for one another. They're taking meals to new mothers. They're taking care of sick people. And I'm involved somewhat. I'm on the homemaking committee. And I feel that sometimes we become our own worst enemy. And I don't know the solution to this, but I feel there's got to be a way that we can express ourselves and not be so afraid that we're going to hurt half the women in that room. Because to me, Relief Society should be a sisterhood. I mean, which means we take each other for what we are. And I live in a ward that I'm extremely cautious about what I say. We've lived most of our lives, Jean and I, with a lot of, what's a nice word to say? We've had to be careful. And sometimes it's worked, sometimes it hasn't. But I still feel that somewhere, and I guess I'm such an optimist, that I feel somehow there's a way that we can talk to one another and we can be honest and let each other know what we're feeling. The few times that I've made comments or when I've taught and I've brought everything into the lesson I could possibly do, and have the sisters interact with one another, we've had some really good discussions. And I've gone in fear and trembling, knowing that I probably have brought way too much into this. But after, I've had women come up who have never spoken in Relief Society and said, "Thank you. I just feel for the first time that I can participate in this group, or at least I can feel that I can be a part of this group." And I'm thinking of those women who are there and lonely and feeling estranged, and this is the gospel. And I just feel that we have a responsibility to do everything we can to not alienate, you know, not purpose. I mean, we're not trying to do it on purpose. It's just that some things just alienate some people. And so I think our job is to find creative ways to bring about the message or the purpose of what we're trying to say or teach and include all of those sisters. And I think if we don't do this, that we end up with these lessons that are repetitive and recycled and the same thing. And talking to many sisters who are on the board, who are, you know, are in the stakes and wards, and this isn't all of them, but some who are saying, "We expect you to be creative in those lessons. We expect you to come forth with some new material. We don't expect you to sit there through the same thing every time." I mean, you know, we will turn into robots. And so I just have this great hope. I don't know if it can come about. I struggle with it constantly, and there's a lot of pain. But there's a lot of hope. I think we've got gifts and talent that isn't even tapped, and it's going to require a lot of love and a lot of patience to bring this forth. It won't be easy, and a lot of us will get hurt and do get hurt. But I think it's possible. It may be just unreal, but I've got to hold that hope out, because if I don't, you know, it all doesn't make a lot of sense. So I want to stay hanging in there. I hate to see women leaving. You know, we need you in there.
We want
you there.
But you're saying, they said take these things and be creative. But see, that's what I did. I thought I was being creative, and
I know. Yeah.
I love these ladies. But you find somebody that just can't accept. Maybe it's who you are rather than what you're saying. And that causes problems. I remember my mother said, "Are you just so mad they fired you?" And I said, "No." I said, "But I really understand what they did. I feel bad because I miss doing it a lot." But I said, "I understand that they, you know, like my sister said, if you have a brain, then you become conflicted and it is a struggle."
Yeah.
I sense that you've got some pain there.
No, you know, but I'm just glad now they've given me one of the hardest jobs they have, and that is the 14, 15-year-old Sunday school class. But, you know, I mean, it is so challenging, but they've gone through so many teachers, and I'm just glad. Well, I think some will, and I think I just think we've got to do it somehow. And I know one time I sat in a lesson, and the state president and his wife were visiting a ward conference, I guess, or something. But they said something in Relief Society about Adam and Eve, and you know they were kind of dumping on Eve and making fun of Adam in a way too. And I raised my hand and I said, well, you know, the way I read the Pearl of Great Price, blah 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 blah. And I expressed this, and then immediately the state president was correcting me in Relief Society, and I thought, well, maybe I didn't make that clear. I was quoting. So I raised my hand again. I said, maybe I could clarify this. Maybe I could, you know, explain to you what I was saying. And then, you know, came to the rescue again and clarified, made sure that they, you know, the sisters were understanding this. Right, that he was saying. And I thought after, you know, we'll have this chat. I was sitting just one person over from him. And we'll talk about this. And, I mean, isn't that what you do? You know, you have these kind of misunderstandings. You're different. You talk about it. And, well, it didn't happen. And I did, you know, and I thought, you know, then I thought after, I mean, I was really hurt. I felt so demolished. I felt so embarrassed. I had been really put down among my sisters there. And so what I should have done after, I think, was go up and say, you know, I need to talk to you about this. There's something that I felt that I was misunderstood, but maybe, you know, maybe we could just talk this over. I think that's what we have to do. And I really want to say in my Relief Society class sometimes is just say, you know, I'm feeling this, and I feel very anxious because I feel some disapproval by some sisters. I don't want that feeling. I want to create a feeling here that's good, and we're different from one another. Every one of us is different from another, but let's talk about it. Let's feel that we have enough love for each other that we can receive each other in this manner. But, you know, it's hope.
One of the questions that I asked the panel to think about was what specific, other than the obvious, what makes Relief Society different from other aspects of the church? And we're talking about Relief Society clashing up against leadership and men, but I think within Relief Society what we've heard is the tremendous potential for human connection, which I think really exists in Relief Society. It's incredible. You know, I hear things from the sisters that are very intimate and see relationships amongst the sisters and conversations in Relief Society that are just unparalleled in their level of closeness and intimacy. At the same time, there's tremendous potential for bitchiness, which is, I think, what we're hearing here. And
self-policing.
I think that's exactly it, that what happens is I very much doubt that it was a male leader that got you guys fired. It was some woman that didn't like what you were saying. And I will continually convey to my husband in irritation or frustration things that have gone on amongst the sisters, and he'll go, but like men and priesthood just don't care, you know, they just couldn't give a crap about any of this stuff. So while there's that tremendous potential for just powerful closeness, there's also that potential, I think, as Allison said, for self-policing, which is very destructive, which happens all the time with women.
Has that been? This seems like a new thing. Maybe it's because I'm a little kid, but has there always been that self-policing within our own kind?
Our own kind. Ratting on each other, yeah.
What I think is happening, I remember these sites a long time ago, and there was a lot more tolerance than there is now. Mm-hmm. And the way I feel about it is that the change has come from the top. There is less tolerance at the top. The purge showed that. And I think I really don't see there being a possibility of a change in that. But if we as sisters can somehow teach each other to tolerate differences, I don't know how to do it, but I know that it's got to be done, because it's not going to come from the top. If we don't learn to tolerate each other and to tolerate differences, I just don't know what's going to happen. It's not going to come from the man.
I'll let Allison speak. I'm sorry, Carol, and then Allison.
I wish we had a little more time, because I want to ask you a question, and that is, does anyone remember when you joined Relief Society and you paid 50 cents dues and you were voted on, and I think you paid dues every year? And the only reason I'm raising this question for people to take home, because there's no time to talk about it, is the economics is behind a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Allison.
I'm going to say one word on the economics. My question that I wrote was,
oh, yes.
We used to make our hamburger on Tuesday. We sold it at our bazaar. We paid our own way. And we decided not to spend the money. And now we are given what we deserve from the So we have no autonomy. We need to make the decision.
Allison, and then we'll take one more comment. Thank you. Go ahead, Allison.
Abraham Lincoln said if you had a stump that was too great to burn and too big to pull, you plowed out around it.
Stand up. I can't hear the
Abraham Lincoln said if he had a stump that was too green to burn and too big to pull, he plowed out around it. I'm very much encouraged at the ways in which the women have learned to plow out around the problem. I keep that up.
Oh, well. I think one way to do that and to try to strike the balance is to present things in personal terms. And that's why I said I think maybe I lack courage, because retrospectively, I think what I might like to have done in this past lesson was to say, sisters, I've been thinking about this lesson, Gifts of the Spirit, for a while, and I am pained by what I see when I know some of our history as sisters. I know, here's a diary quote from 1872, here's a diary quote from 1901, and now I read in the General Handbook, this is our policy now. This is our legacy. It pains me that things have changed. What can we do? I mean, maybe not, I don't know, what can we do, or how might we still own this legacy in creative ways in our own lives? And maybe, I mean, I think some of it is that I'm worried not only about getting fired, but I'm worried about how I'm perceived. And I'm kind of upset that probably was a big part in why I did what I did. Mm-hmm. And I think if I had it to do over again, I would try to make it as sort of present a problem, a puzzle that I struggle with in personal terms rather than in the form of a diatribe or some kind of vendetta, but just this is my struggle, and let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think we need to finish. I very much appreciate it and wish we had more time. Thanks for coming to the session.